Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
To the sixth of our seven series installment here, of which, you know, I have been so enlightened and fascinated, it's sent me into all sorts of research before I've even gotten through the whole book. I have Gary Wayne with me here again tonight, and we're talking about his Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2 book. And as was graphically described in the first Genesis 6 Conspiracy book, there are giants among us, passing largely unnoticed, intent on carrying out a secret plan to enslave all of humanity. They may not look like giants today, but their bloodlines and DNA extend all the way back to the Nephilim, the offspring of the angels who mated with human women, described in Genesis 6 when the giants were roaming the land. Now in his new book, Gary goes in-depth with new information and expansions for each premise laid out in the first book. By adding this fact-filled book to your understanding, you'll be able to clearly understand and articulate how we are living in the end of time. I'm not sure, you know, it's the kind of book you're going to have to read more than once or twice or three times, but the material is fascinating, and every time I go back and reread something, I find something new that I have to ask questions about, which is exciting. This book was written to help answer the lingering questions many Christians have and to provide scripturally researched answers and data points for these questions. The Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2 explores Scripture's accounting of prehistory history and its important prophetic connections and explains in layman's terms how it all fits together in the deciphering of the end time. And I promise you, he does. He brings it right down. He takes you way back and he moves you forward. And it's fascinating and it's exciting. And now that we're, you know, getting close to the very, very end, I am finding that I'm recognizing names and places and things like that. So he brings his research to current day, just about. Well, actually, he does to current day, and traces the bloodlines back and explains who they are, who they're connected to, and he gives you a hierarchy of the conspiracy that is going on and has gone on since the beginning of time. It's fascinating material. It's so well worth getting the book and working your way through it and possibly listening to each of the interviews after each section, which may help you to go back, reread it, and understand even more deeply what's been going on, and look forward in the future, because in the fall we're going to do the exact same thing with his Genesis 6 conspiracy book, and even though I have read through it three times, I will find myself doing exactly the same thing that I'm doing now, and being so grateful to Gary for sharing his time, his energy, his wisdom, his knowledge, and his humor with us for so many different weeks. It's been a pleasure and a thrill. And I should let him come on and talk too, I guess. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Well, thank you for inviting me back, and thank you so much for the very kind words on your opening. And, you know, so glad that you're enjoying the read as you go through it. And it's such a large topic and such a complicated topic. And, you know, hopefully, and by what I'm hearing from yourself and others is that there's a lot of information in there, but it sort of reads in a way that sort of keeps you reading. And hopefully people will find the information important and help them clarify things for themselves in terms of what the world is all about. And I think Section 6 that we're going to talk about tonight is something that is not talked about a whole bunch in most other books and genres. If they are, it's just sort of in sort of pieces. So it's an interesting section in itself, like all the sections are. So I think people are going to be fascinated by some of the things that we're going to talk about in Section 6 tonight.
Well, I think one of the things that I think will help people is that if they get your book after we're done with our seven series or before, but if they read the first section and then they listen to the interview that we did and then go back and reread it, they're going to have a lot of aha moments. And it's a wonderful study guide, to be honest with you, that we've provided. And I think, you know, it's free. It's on YouTube, guys. It's not anything that they have to buy. But having it broken up like this, and each of the sections is between 1 and 200 pages. They aren't large sections. If you read through it, then you listen to the interview, then you go back and read through it again, you'll find that not only are you understanding it better, but you have, well, obviously more questions too, and Gary is the kind of person that will answer your questions. So it's a cool way to go through the book. It's been a thrill for me. It really has been. And every now and then I'll hit a section that I am just so tickled with because it was like, okay, here are a lot of my questions here. And in this last section that we read, which is prehistory and prophecy, you know, here's where I was connecting names that I recognize and you know, how the Templars were shifted around and how it, there really is a conspiracy here. This isn't just history. It's a roadmap for a conspiracy to enslave humanity. And I don't think anybody understands that.
Well, I think the whole concept of it is just so massive that, you know, the easy thing to do and what most people's tendency are is to sort of say, that can't be true. That just changes everything. And how do I get my head around all of this, and what do I do with that information if it were true? So I understand why people may want to, learn about it. But what I found is that it actually helped me to understand the world, and I'm at least better at peace with myself, understanding how the world works and what the history is, and I understand better what's going on, and I may not be able to change things, but I can maybe perhaps influence things to a certain degree and maybe open people's eyes to something larger that they ought to be aware of. And, yeah, it's crazy to think that there is this perpetual back and forth in this continuous plan to enslave humankind and to ultimately... The original endeavor was to ensure humankind is not resurrected and indict the angelic rebellion in the process and to be raised up like angels, but distinct from the angels, and to actually judge the fallen angels that started all of this and let all of their spurious offspring carry out all of the things that they wanted done to humankind, to wipe them from memory and not to be resurrected, and that they didn't want to get the blood on their hands. So that's why when we talked about the invisible ones and the visible ones, you have to understand both realms of that and how that carries out in what we've seen throughout prehistory, history today, and where we seemingly are heading. So, and as Section 6 kind of opens up, we start to get into more recent history and start talking more about different kinds of prophecies and get into some prophecy, but we sort of bring pieces that wasn't sort of talked about in the finishing stages in preparation for the end time. You know, organizations and bloodlines and people in this section that is all new information really being added on to what I talk about in book one. So, and I was wondering, you know, when I did this section, how is it going to actually sort of make it work to start make that connection and transition out of all of the giant wars of the Exodus and then sort of move it into the end time. And I realized I needed that transition section as well, and just found that there was pieces in there that just seemed to fit together that would set up Section 7, which gets into the future times. So I opened up Section 6, and the section's called Prehistory, History, and Prophecy. That's sort of reflect that sort of transition that we're trying to get people to understand and get people to understand that information that was talked about before is relevant in this section, and even more so in the last section. And parts of this section are absolutely essential to understand Section 7. So you could read Section 7 on its own, but you're way better prepared after reading Section 6. So I open the section up with an interesting verse, because I start off with some interesting chapters in Section 6 where the, you know, 58, 59, 60, and 61 are unusual sort of chapters to have in a book, let alone a prophecy book, let alone a prehistory book. But I'll give the names of the titles, because it's called 58 is Pharaoh and the Beast Empires. And that's going to be very important information to understand the Beast Empires for the end time and how they've affected history. Tyrus and Shebna as some very important prehistory information that applies to the end time, as well as the mystery trees of Eden and the terrible ones. And so I'm going to read the quote I have for putting up the section, because I think it's important and it sort of down the understanding for those chapters that I would sort of group together as essential for understanding something called the dual prophecy. I'll explain that a little more in a sec. So I open to 2 Peter 3:3, and the passage says this out of the New Testament, 2 Peter. It says, knowing this first, shall come in the last days, scoffers walking after their own lusts and saying, where is the promise of his coming? And we haven't got there yet. We get a little bit, but not like what's going to happen when we get into the last 7 years. Then it goes and says, for since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that was being overflowed with water perished. But the heavens and the earth which are now by the same world are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men. And so there's more to this, but this is a classic dual prophecy that shows up in the New Testament. And there's many of these, what I call dual prophecies, that are in the Old Testament. And so what we're getting here is classic dual prophecy, and it's my term. I made it up. I just didn't know what to call it when I saw that these passages were not in contradiction. They're just unique. And so they give you important information out of prehistory. And as it connects into nothing is new under the sun, what was will be again. And then as you move on in Ecclesiastics 1, that you understand that this wisdom will bring nothing but grief and sorrow to you, is there's a cycle of things that are going on. We've talked a little bit about that in the show's past. So in the prehistory, even though it's talking about in the end time when they're saying, where is this coming? This has been saying this since the beginning of time. We get this information that the earth was standing out of the water and in the water, and whereby the world that then was being overflowed by water, which perished. This is not the flood. The earth did not perish. This is talking about the destruction that is likely happened in Genesis 1:1-2, where you have a destruction of the earth likely in the angelic rebellion and destroyed by fire. Just as that same destruction that's describing this destruction is also reserved for the end time. So you get that sort of fulfillment. And that the earth that is standing out of the water and in the water and then was overflowed by the water is the separation of the waters that happens in the renewal of the earth in days 1-6. But in the angelic war, you had an earth perishing condition right down probably to the foundations of the earth, where the waters above that make the firmament that are described in Genesis 1 with the creation of the firmament by the separating of the waters to create life underneath, that water fell down onto the earth and created this chaos, which had to be renewed by separating the waters. And so that was a destruction by fire. The flood that happens later is one that God promises never to do again, but is also talking about in this passage that the end time is reserved for fire. So all of the destruction that we see that's going to happen in the end time is a destruction by fire. And so you have an end time implication to the information of this prehistory. And then just as people would have been saying in the time of the disciples, because the disciples thought Jesus was coming back in that generation, where is this coming? And that did not happen. And so they're still talking about that, but it's going to be further enhanced. So the fullness of the prophecy isn't completely fulfilled in the time of the prophet. And the book of Revelation starts off that way as well. Not only is it the testimony of Jesus given to the angel to show John in a vision, it has six letters that are preceding the actual catastrophes and the events of the end time. So you're having this section that's explaining about the throne of heaven, and then you get the letters to the churches that are represented in heaven, and that these descriptions of the churches, what they're blessed for and what they're warned about, all of those events that are talked about are not completely fulfilled in the time of John. And there are some events in each that are reserved for the end time. It actually gives a bit of a chronology in there as well. And so you get this dual prophecy in Revelation, where not all the events are happening in the time of the prophet. There's in the time of the prophet, and there's events that are reserved, let's say, for like the 10 days of tribulation or the saving from the time of trial, as two classic examples, the fulfillment for in the last 7 years. And so, and you also have that information about the throne, and then you have the rest of Revelation that is going to give prophecies about the end time and can overlay onto the chronology that Jesus talked about in his oration to the disciples in Matthew 24, Mark 13, Luke 17, and 21. And so you have that classic sort of dual prophecy. And that's why I want to start people off in this transition talking about the Pharaoh and the beast empires. We need to understand what a beast empire is, and we need to understand that Pharaoh that's being talked about is one of the royales of the giants that are ruling these beast empires. And Pharaoh is like an archetype of an end-time Antichrist figure. He's even described in Ezekiel 29 as a dragon, as part of that whole archetypical understanding. So what happens in the time of Ezekiel in these passages that are going to be talked about, you know, that are going to reflect Ezekiel 26, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32 that I've grouped there, our typical archetypical dual prophecy, where we're going to get very important information about prehistory in those prophecies. It's going to be applicable to the prophet of that time and the time of Nebuchadnezzar in this case, and the destruction of the southern kingdom and the destruction of nations like Tyre and Egypt in that apocalyptic-like war that happens. And it's going to provide details that are going to be reflective of what the Antichrist will be like and what he's going to do. And so this is sort of the beginning of pulling that information out of prehistory and starting to apply it to the end time. So I thought I'd stop and let you in there, because I went down quite a road there. So
you did. I think though, you've laid such a great foundation, so that as you move into the what we're seeing, you know, in the last 100 or so years, and the changes that have occurred by intent, and how I don't know, what would you call the people that are of the bloodlines that are in this conspiracy, what would you call them? Because we're not looking at history, we're looking at living history. We're looking at bloodlines that are still in power, that are still working towards a common goal of one world order, among other things. And so that, what would you call them? I mean, you can't call them beasts, because, well, I guess you could. I think what when you're looking at history and you're talking about beast empires and stuff like that, that's history, and you know, you can throw that name around. But they're still here today. These genealogies have traveled through time with a purpose within them that it's amazing. I mean, you have the Plantagenets, you have the Borgias, you have all of these lines, genealogical lines, that their intent, a level of them, is intent on a conspiracy to bring the world to its knees. And, you know, you name them, they're there. And your book is, you know, all the way up here has shown how throughout time, these people, these genealogies, they have worked a process, and when something happens and, you know, one thing doesn't work, treasuries are turned over to another bloodline to be able to carry this all on. I mean, this is something that is so evil that it boggles the mind that underneath all of our noses, things that we have thought were positive and you know, the Jesuits and you know, all of these things that we thought were holy and working towards the posterity of Jesus and his work are turn out to not be that. And it's frightening how we have been hoodwinked throughout time. The Templars and the Masons, and you know, there are levels of these organizations that are working towards something that is definitely not to the benefit of humanity, in my opinion.
Well, they're working to their own benefit. They would imagine themselves as superior beings coming as the descendants from the gods, and are superior to humankind, and that they want to inherit this world forever, but not necessarily with humankind. And so, but their goal was, I mean, why they were created as by the fallen angels is to carry this out and to try and make sure that humankind does not reach their destiny. You know, there was a a threshold that was passed in 1 Corinthians where the princes of this world, if they had known about the resurrection and how all of this was going to play out through free choice with humankind and the ability to have that resurrection to be raised immortal, had they known that, they wouldn't have crucified Jesus. They didn't know that. And from that point on, I think the fallen angels are misleading their offspring and the descendants of their offspring that they can still win. And so that's their only opportunity they see of getting to be a god in the physical world and to honor and worship their spurious celestial mafia godfathers. And so I think in the next chapter, actually we'll start to link, or in the next section I'll actually start to link this sort of spirit that they have as a spiritual beast, because they're not doing, you know, this is the obvious reasons of them not doing good things, and one of the reasons why they're called terrible ones. But they have this inert nature to want to slander God. They want to deny everything about God and want to be rebellious against the God, just as their godfathers were. And so they are hubris, and they talk with such narcissism and confidence that they can do what they plan to do. And they had a lot of practice controlling societies because they control top two classes throughout history, which can, you know, include not just royalty class in terms of the kings and the queens, but the larger nobility. You know, they controlled all of the priests of the religions, which is why they set up the black nobility within the Pope line. And they controlled the religions of polytheism all through the elite level. And they controlled all of the armies, because they controlled the armies, and the humans are the pawns in front of that sort of understanding. And they controlled all of the education. They controlled all of the literature, all of the recording of history. They controlled everything and are experts that they pass down through the generations on how to maintain control. And part of that is keeping humankind in servitude and dumbed down for the purposes of what they're trying to accomplish. Now, every royale that's born in, that's of the upper level of purity or nobleness, has a role from the time that they're born. And they're to participate in that organizational structure. And they have an organizational structure just like the fallen angels have, as we talked about the Assembly of the Gods and how that was originally sort of passed down to the Assembly of the Tanu, that we talked about earlier on as well, as being the kings of this, like Lord of the Rings, that they control the earth through the 70 nations and the gods that rule over those 70 nations. And so they've been in control of that, but they have hierarchy within those bloodlines, which is part of their organizational structure, and they have very, very high-end Royal Masonic orders that sort of the top end of that bloodline hierarchy that would be part of the 13 families, they would all have their own specific Royal Masonic order. So with the Anjou family, for example, it would be the Knights of the Golden Fleece. And if that sounds familiar, that comes out of Greek mythology. And in that understanding, the Golden Fleece is the material that the clothing for the gods, and one presumes for the demigods, for many of them, had their clothes made of. And so when they're trying to spin stuff into this gold-type product that it's described as, it's designed to give the body physical immortality in the physical world so that it won't die or grow old or decay. And so, the, you know, and bloodlines of the Norse are the Knights of the Seraphim. You have an order of Windsors or the Hanovers, as they're probably better connected to the royales, as the Order of the Garter, not the lower one that prime ministers and that are awarded into, because they usually have a senior and a junior order associated with these royales. So they've had an ability to keep control, and they've been working towards this destiny for generations after generations. And one of the issues with them is that they can't quite get it done for a lot of reasons. One is there's an ordained time, but within their rivalries that they have, they are sometimes their own worst enemies at getting it done. And so at the end of the day, if you sort of play it all out, there can only be one, just as in the Highlander series that I like to quote every once in a while, you know, with the taking of the heads and everything else, and the quickening and all the terms that are part of the fairy patriarchal bloodline allegory. But there can only be one dynastic family at the end. There'll be other important dynastic families, but there can only be one that's going to set up this thousand-year reign or reign of eternity with that bloodline. So they're kind of at war with each other, working directionally to get where they want to go, but only with one family sort of rising to the top. So, yeah, and control that, it's unimaginable how many organizations that you have to have to make that happen, and that you have to have people you can trust assigned heading up those organizations and leading those organizations.
Well, I think what really began to throw me for a loop, first of all, with the Templars, one of the oaths they take is to, you know, wipe out Christianity. And when you look at the fact that things like the Catholic Church is part of this whole thing, the Pope is part of this whole thing, you look around and you say, okay, easy to spot the bad guys, but there's usually two sides to one of these things. And as far as I can tell, the safest place you can be is to worship internally and not in an organization, to educate yourself as to the life and times of Jesus and of course just the red stuff in the Bible. And if you live by that, chances are you're not going to get sucked into one of these other organizations, because when you start to see, oh, this looks holy, this looks positive, when you look into it, the deeper you look into it, you realize at the very core of it is a rotten theory and philosophy, and you're being led by the nose down a pathway that is going to take you to the fiery pit too. So it's a matter of, you know, not joining a group, but rather understanding the pure love message that is out there and not being sucked into any of these other groups. I mean, there's no group that you can join that doesn't have the Nephilim at the core, I don't think.
Yeah, they've invaded everything from the seminary schools and most of the churches with the leadership and things. And we see that manifested in the understanding that and sort of the reason for the writing of this book is because Christians are saying, they're not teaching us the whole Bible. They're only teaching us sort of some of the values and the principles, but we lose the whole context. And the greater part of the Bible is prehistory and prophecy, and they don't teach that. They're taught in seminary schools not to teach that. And then they only want to teach the sanitized versions of the principles and things like that. So there's this continual sort of preparing Christians to be deceived. And if we are in the fig tree generation, and I think that we might be, then we can't trust our church leaders as we're going into this period of turmoil. So yeah, it's an important thing to understand that we need to take the understanding on ourselves, and we need to learn. And we need to learn how this world works, and we try and do sort of stand up and push back. And we've seen throughout history that, you know, when good people stand up, you can push things back. But if they can continually subdivide us and turn us against each other, then there's no organized resistance to them. And they use polar opposite. You know, they have a term in the occult of the white hats and the black hats, and that the black hats, you know, want to hit the same goal as the white hats, but they don't have any consideration for humanity. And on the other hand, you have the white hats that have humanity's better interest at heart, is what they're saying, but they have the same goal and the destination to get to that same point, and they work the same pantheon of God. So it's hard to believe that they don't have exactly the same kind of belief in ideology for the most part, just slightly different tactics on how to get there. It's kind of like looking at the standard establishment party in Washington, where you would have things of common ground as being like a uniparty, as people like to call them, where they want to move towards globalism, they want perpetual war, and they want a new world order based on values that would be sort of understood as you're growing up as an American or a Canadian in Canada. So they have all of the things that they need to do to cattle herd people in that direction, but still they have trouble getting it done. And that's going to be sort of part of how this plays out. We want to be careful not to get ahead of end-time chronology so that we don't lose our credibility, but we want to be able to get this information out as to, you know, why we think we're in the period of time and how we got there. And what I liked about, you know, going through this part is section six, as I moved out of these dual prophecies of Ezekiel, which I find it should be very, very informative to Christians who are trying to understand some of that Old Testament prophecy. But once you get that concept down, you can recognize those prophecies instantly and then weed out what didn't happen in the prophet, understand that prehistory stuff is contextual information for us, and then look at the end time nuggets are in there that we need to pull out. But I was getting into how do I now sort of transition this back into the modern wedge of conspiracy in the West, and I thought I'd go back and finish off some of the things that I didn't do in book for reasons I didn't want to make a longer book. And I didn't think maybe people were ready for some of the things that I added in this book. And there was controversy over the Jesuit fit and how hot they are. So I started back again with the beginning of the Knights Templar, which is the modern wedge of modern secret societies as we understand it today. You know, started from royals, not from poor monks, in that there was an order almost right out of the get-go, was what I call a senior order and a junior order, that sort of evolved into each of those types of levels having junior orders as well. And so you could look at that within the Templar, where you have the adepts within the order, that would be leadership of the junior order, but then they have all the ones underneath that aren't yet adepts. And that would be part of the junior order. So you had this Council of the Barons that I talked about that are going to elect the kings of Jerusalem that will come from these Knights Templars from the beginning, with Baldwin being from Lorraine, and Hugh de Payan, who doesn't become a king but becomes the first Grand Master of the Knights Templar, firmly assembled with the formalization of junior order to the senior order of barons, and he's going to be the first Grand Master of the Knights Templar moving forward in 1118, when the first King of Jerusalem title is crowned at the small priory on the Rock of Sion. And in that process, I start to link up who these barons are and how they're connected to the priory of Sion. And one of the things I heard back a lot from people who we took issue with me, including the Priory of Sion, even though I sort of left it at, you know, there is a lot of historical evidence that suggests that they existed, but we see evidence of it in the Grand Master's list and showed how that would interconnect in after the splitting of the Knights Templar from the Senior Order of Barons in 1188 at the cutting of the elm, when the Priory of Sion or the Barons split away because the Templars had lost their way and lost Jerusalem. That was the key thing, and that was the most important thing, in that they weren't there to support the Templars in 1307 as the senior order that could protect it, because they're all senior royales of Europe. They could have done protection, but they let the order fall. And then they had to regroup those into decentralized organizations after the fall of the Knights Templar. So one of the things I looked at was people were saying, the research that's being done in like the whole, Holy Blood and Holy Grail, and they're quoting certain sources but not really going to the heart of it. So what I did in this book is I went right to where many of these historians are getting the information, and right from the King of Tyre in terms of that work, and also through the Catholic Bible and other very, very old sources of history out of the Middle Ages that were linking these organizations. And I put that history together and tried the records that I know who the Priory of Sion was, where it was located, and how the whole inside organization worked in terms of the Templar order and then the bloodlines of the King of Jerusalem. And it all is part of how we get to the modern wedge of the Masonic orders of the royal bloodlines and the Thelemic tree of their organizational structure. So I walk people through that. There's a lot of detail in there, but it's a significant sort of mini narrative in the book of intrigue.
Oh, absolutely. And I loved it how, the Templars were the first bankers, and what they created has tumbled through time, actually, and it's still there. And I think that what got me was that I always thought the Templars were the good guys, and then you got into their worship and the fact that they were polytheistic and that they did not worship Jesus. They worshipped Mary. And the worship of Mary or a female spiritual leader goes way back in time. And it's almost as though, back to Isis and even, way before. And to me, it was fascinating that they rever the female as opposed to the male, which I found fascinating.
Well, and as you do research with the secret societies, they say the higher that you go up is you recognize the importance of the female mother goddess over the patriarchal god. I mean, there's still the dualism, but the mother goddess is considered more powerful and more important. And so if you consider that analogy, I think we talked about in terms of some of the giant wars and how hornets were used against them, but they like that hive allegory, just as the bees is part of the Catherine imagery that's part of the bloodline. And within the beehive, you have the queen, and it's at the top. And then you have the royal drones, which are important, and you have to have them, but they're a little bit lower than the mother goddess. And it's the one that provides, the fertility to the whole hive. And you have that understanding as the mother goddess in polytheism, particularly as it comes out in Gnosticism, which would be the ultimate mother goddess of knowledge. The Holy Spirit is sort of equated with from a polytheist perspective, and that this is the goddess Sophia, who through some nebulous light force created the 12 archons that populated the 12 parts of the zodiac. and that these were the original archons that ruled the earth, and that God was in that understanding was one of those 12 archons, and so no more stronger or no more knowledgeable than other archons, or particularly as one that they would raise up as being equal, we would understand in Christianity as the degraded angelic form that we know Satan. And so, again, that word Sophia, it just sort of permeates through our world, if we think about that, because that's the word for wisdom. We get that out of Greek. So she's also the goddess of wisdom and the supplier of all knowledge. And philosophy guides our education today and is the arbitrator between the seven liberal arts. And the sciences is what created the Indian mysticism that I talk about in Book 1. And that's the religion that crosses the flood. And that's the religion that's represented in Babel. And that's the root word, Hebrew word for Babylon, for the end time. And this religious understanding of Sophia and Gnosticism, we see that coming through a word called philosophy, which means the love of Sophia, love of wisdom, the love of the mother goddess who supplies all of that wisdom. And it's theology and the arbitrator of the sciences. Or if we see as an extension of the Gnostic religion, creation of theosophy that was made populous by Madame Blavatsky in about the 1880s, and the source religion that morphed into Ariosophy for National Socialism, you know, that means the god Sophia. I mean, you can't get more sort of obvious as to the importance of the mother goddess. And so this is also understood as a queen of heaven. And we get the term the queen of heaven that rituals are made even by the Israelites at certain times in the book of Jeremiah, title for all of the other goddesses in all the different pantheons. And whether it's an offspring god or a parent god, it's the same title representing the same position, and they're all fertility goddesses, they're all wisdom goddesses, and they're also war goddesses.
So when these different phases happen through time, they're not specifically talking about Mary Magdalene as much as they're talking about the Queen of Heaven, the Queen of, you know, what it polytheistically, so that it's more a title than it is a person.
Yes, it is, and in various times and in different cultures, there's different Queen of Heaven. So, you know, Isis is understood as an offspring god after the flood, as a Queen of Heaven, and Osiris is an offspring god. And they're both allegories. Osiris is the allegory as a sun god for the ultimate god, even though they would have a place in rank in the order. But the allegory of it is an allegory of true chief god, of the patriarch gods, and that Isis is a allegory for the true king of heaven, as you take that to its original form. And it's thought that in that thought process is that just as Isis and Osiris in this allegory, and this is the allegory that the Freemasons use, and then Horus would be the sun or a Messiah-type figure in the Trinity that they celebrate most loudly. They do it in all the different cultural religions, but that's the one more pronounced. That in the original sort of state when Satan was still, before he was degraded to Satan status, he would have had a partner, and that's the allegory that's being reflected in the Queen of Heaven. So it would be very much apropos to Sophia being above the lower level Queen of Heaven, as the ultimate one that would have had over the council of the gods with Satan at one time. And it's kind of parallel to the story of Leviathan, that is the serpentine creature that the female had to be destroyed in history lest the whole earth would be destroyed. And that this might be the ultimate mother goddess being talked about from a Christian perspective, because Leviathan is going to be dealt with in the end time, just as the female one was done before. I mean, you get this account in all parts of history of Tiamat being destroyed, or Lotan being destroyed, or Virta being destroyed, in all continents all around the world, where you have God that is doing battle with this female Leviathan type God, so that the world can continue. For whatever reasons, this exists, but it's sort of portrayed in polytheism that this is their offspring gods who are trying to overthrow the parent gods, which eventually do in polytheism. I don't think they actually overthrow them. I think the parent gods all go to the pit prison, and then the offspring gods move. But all of that is built in with this ongoing sort of mythos of the Mary apparition, and it's going to be very important to understand that connection as we get into the end time and as we get into section 7.
Well, how does that work with creating a world religion where you have the Christians, the Jews, and the Muslims? How can you blend all of that into something that they can shove down our throats?
Well, they have to do certain things. So from a religious unification, you need to bring back what they would say the monotheist religions that went rogue and bring them back into the home religion. So they'll work at it from two different ends. And from the one end, they'll work at it bringing Moses into it, where they believe he was educated at Heliopolis, and he was biblically. He was an adept biblically, and he would have swore all of the oaths and was raised as a royale. And that this is the religion, according to the polytheists, that he brought back to the land of the covenant as he led Israel into the wilderness and then through the wars of the covenant land. And that at some time during the monarchy, King Saul and King David, that religion went rogue, and to increase the mythos of the monarchy, they went to a monotheistic religion. And so they believe that the true roots to monotheism is polytheism. And you have a connection at Moses between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that they all look at Moses as a very, very important patriarch, just as Abraham was, who also came out of a polytheist state. And they will argue Abraham was a polytheist. And they do adopt in, and I cover how, in book one, how the suspects in the secret society adopt Abraham in as a patriarch. They do all the different patriarchs to sort of have that built in for the end time. So that's part one. But the two things that they have to do in terms of Christianity is deal with Jesus as to how you understand who Jesus was and is. And from the polytheistic perspective and the Catholic perspective, accept Jesus as a prophet and a great teacher, but mortal, and that he didn't die on the cross, and that Mother Mary is understood allegorically as the mother of God, in this case Jesus, but they don't believe Jesus is a God, so it's just the term that they use to associate with polytheism, as with Horus being the son of Isis, which is why that's the imagery that you get for Mary and Jesus within the church. It's the Egyptian imagery, and it's done in preparation. So they have to de-deify Jesus. So one of the attacks is going to come from destroying Paul, just as Paul is related by the ascetic movement, the originalists take their religion back to Heliopolis as the guardians of the knowledge, as I cover up in book one. And for Christians who want more of a biblical and church father historic perspective on the Essenes. Get a hold of me through my website at genesis6conspiracy.com. That's the number six. Ask for the Essene document. I'll send it to you. It's the premise that I used to biblical premise that I used that I didn't use much in book one because I wanted to let the other side speak in their own words. But if you want the Christian biblical side, I have a special document. Just ask me for it. And so they're going to as with the Essenes, as with a lot of the Dead Sea Scrolls, they talk about the teacher of righteousness and the heretic, the father of lies. And so they looked at Jesus as one of those teachers of righteousness, as a great teacher and a prophet. They looked at Paul as the heretic. So they say Paul who took Jesus to deity status, and his teachings are false. So they have to destroy Paul. And then they have to go after the deity credentials for Jesus. And so get that through saying that they're going to have alleged evidence to support from what I'm told. And that people are going to believe that it's the message of Jesus, and he's one of many that came along the way, as I described in book one, as opposed to the actual word of God, and that he survived the cross. And that he married Mary Magdalene, started descendants that were intermarried into the lines that show up to the Merovingians through scioning in Davidic lines, Benjamite lines of King Saul, and the Jesus and Mary Magdalene bloodlines that were passed joined into the Merovingian bloodline that passed on through the last Merovingian king, Dagobert, to the Anjou, Guglielmo, and the Payan families of Lorraine that show up at the Knights Templar and are going to establish that King of Jerusalem title in 1118, that they would presume that the Antichrist is going to declare himself as the King of Jerusalem through that pedigree. But qualify all of that, that is one of the important bloodlines that will be looking to become that bloodline that's going to supply what I would call the Dragon Messiah, or what we know biblically as the Antichrist. And so they have to de-deify Jesus. They don't have to completely destroy him. They just have to bring him down to how the Gnostics understand him and other religions, that he was an important teacher and a prophet. And like Confucius, he would be like Buddha, he would be like Mohammed, he would be like Confucius, if I didn't say that one, or Hermes, and a whole list of these ones that said were sent on the way to help humankind evolve into godhood. So for those kinds of ways to all but destroy Christianity, but leave it in a way that it can be a branch of this upcoming universal religion. So that's going to take some time. So and they're going to need false prophets, and they're going to need catastrophes to make that all come about. So again, one of the reasons why I said that's be careful of getting ahead of all of the important things that have to happen before we start plunging in and saying we're already in the civil judgments or the trumpets or even further along some other people. So yeah, it's a chore. And but say they have the evidence and they're prepared to bring out certain dates already planned.
Wow. Well, having this knowledge, being able to, you've given a roadmap here that is really quite profound, and it to me seems as though it's almost a clarion call to wake up and understand that there is an agenda here, and I understand that I think once in I don't know which book we were talking about, and I said, you know, you're going to the Rephaim and, you know, all of the Cain's bloodline and everything, and I said, what about the good guys? I mean, are there good guys? It seems that this conspiracy is so profound, how does one fight it? How does one negate it? How does one turn your back on it and walk in another direction? How do you do that when it surrounds you? It's in every aspect of life. How are those who really want to move in the right direction, how do they find it? Because this roadmap you've got covers just about everything.
Well, they control everything. And we need to understand we swim in the Gentile sea. We swim in the polytheist sea. They control all aspects. And so even so, some light shines through. They can't stop everything. And we all have free choice. And that's why we have to do our due diligence to learn. And at the end of the day, you're going to come down to, once you pull back the curtain to see the wizards that are running these things, whether you're secular, polytheist, or monotheist, or agnostic, once you pull that back, then you have to make a decision, and you're going to find out those decisions are narrowed down to one or the other. And it's that sort of macro good versus evil, yin and yang, that they talk about in polytheism, where there's never one side that's going to get the upper hand of the other. And that's not really true. I mean, it is from the polytheist side in the dualism, but not from monotheist side. So and we see it play out with the white hat and the black hat, and within the polytheist world that you know, run by the Council of the Gods and assembly of the divine ones, the offspring of the fallen angels and their descendants, and God, you know, is the God of this world. I mean, they control all of that, but we have the ability to say, why are we here? What should I do? And what you start doing is learning more and then make a decision. I would love to see more people decide to become Christians, but at the same time, is everybody has free choice. We can't force their belief on anybody. And this whole world that is set up against the monotheism, I mean, they see how powerful that force is if you want to stand and put them back, which has happened at some times and period in our world, but that everybody has to make that choice for themselves, and that's where their strength comes from, is why they try and divide us. But you can do that individually and then start to coalesce. If we're in the ordained time, there's not much we can do to prevent it from coming other than try and help other people learn and hopefully make their decision as well, because choice is the choice. And so you're going to just get dragged along with the wisdom of the world and the people who run this world. So what we need to do is on our own, and then as we learn to try and help others and spread the word in terms of here's how the world works, and you have that choice, or you have a choice that is necessarily coming out of the churches. There's something that's in between. It's what should be taught in the Christian churches more, so that we can understand how we push back against what goes on in the world. So are we going to get a leader that stands up that's going to represent us that way? No, not until the last 7 years are you going to get clear intercession again with sending two witnesses, sending 144,000 to help. In the meantime, we're in the signs. And the only way that we can learn about this is, you know, not only learn about all the things that they immerse us in, maybe learn the other side. And that's why I would encourage people to try and read the Bible, and whether it's in an English, modern English translation or a KJV version, whichever is easier for you to do it, and start learning about it and studying different aspects of it. And, you know, hopefully my book helps in that sort of way to just learning about it, because at the end of the day, it's about yourself and your own personal salvation first, and then other people you can help get there as well. We can't provide salvation. We can only help get them there.
Yeah, I guess, and to to have somebody stand up, an organization stand up and say, this is the way, follow me, I always doubt that. It's like, who are you? And, you know, how do you know your way is the best way? And
exactly. And then when do they get corrupted and hubris and do all of the things that they were organized to not do, sort of like what happened, you know, how the Roman Catholic Church went, you know, got completely sidetracked throughout much of their history. You know, they were trying to force Christianity on people. You can't do that. You're doing what the other side does. They were...
Well, yeah. And you know, their holdings, today, and they're incredibly wealthy, and there is such poverty in the world, and there is such hunger in the world, and it's sort of like, for heaven's sakes, take care of your people. And I there have been a lot of organizations that I have wanted to donate to, but then when I researched it, I found that, you know, of every $100 they got, only about 20 of it went towards their cause. The rest of it was all administrative stuff. And so you get to the point where it's, yes, I want to help, but I want to make sure that you know, there are very few organizations where 95% of the money goes towards their cause. And those are organizations I donate to.
Yeah, it's been like a whole scam industry that was set up on charities, and a lot of times there's, you know, maybe less than 1% of that actually get to the people, just so they have some sort of cover for the whole organization. So yeah, like you, Gail, myself, in that we like to donate where in way it gets directly to the people without any sort of space in between. So, you know, mm-hmm. places like the food bank are, you know, a terrific way to sort of help. You know, things like that, so that the money's going to get there, or the whole ideology that the government is there to create fairness and equity that's out there when they take out 50% right off the top for their costs. don't take that. And then take such a small sliver of that left 50% to that direction, and spending it all on other things that the money wasn't, you know, said to be collected for. So, yeah, it's not the government that's going to help people either in terms of the efficiency of how they get that done. I'm not saying they don't do anything, but the efficiency level it doesn't even hit an F mark, the old grading.
That is true. So in your part six here, you talk about the great and mighty men of the end times. Who are they?
It's again one of those preparatory chapters, and I think it's a very helpful chapter for people. So in the book of Revelation, we're informed about kings, and we're informed about great men and mighty men of the end time. And it's talked about in, you know, Revelation 6, Revelation 18, Revelation 19. And this is also including areas of the time of the seal opening, including the destruction of Babylon, and it's including the Armageddon War. We're talking about these mighty rulers and oligarchs. And they're the ones that are, you know, are sort of controlling everything in this new world order that is going to be coming about. And so the problem with the New Testament, in terms of linking it with the Old Testament, in that the New Testament was recorded in Greek, and the Old Testament was recorded in Hebrew. So where we can make more easily make connections between the royals, the kings, and the Raphaim, and the Gibberim, mighty ones, that are described as the terrible ones, we don't have those same identical words because it's a different language. We have to look for cognitive forms of words that describe the same type of thing and then match that up with processes in the old sort of check our understanding to see whether or not we're getting the right understanding of it. So these are understood in the New Testament as coming from two Greek words, megas and megastrani. And I'll show in the book how the meanings of those words are and understood in the times when they were used that relates back to giants and royal lines. And that these are the same people that I talked about, the Old Testament prophecies. And so when looking at the mighty ones of the end time, as described in the Old Testament, as in the before, these are the royals, these are the kings. So when we look at Ezekiel 38 and 39, which is this war that is going to happen in the end time, and we know the end time because it says latter days. That's a term that's used throughout the Old Testament as those markers for the last 7 years. Now, a lot of people might think and say that the war is the Revelation 9 war, or not the Revelation 9 war, but the Revelation 20 war that happens at the end of the millennium. But it's clearly cited for in Ezekiel 38 for the last days, and I looked at with the alliance there as part of the alliances of these kings that are waging that war. Now, we get clear dating for that in Ezekiel 39, which is the second part, and this is talking about after the fall of, or the wiping out of this great God army, and that after the burying of these of the great Gog army, you have Second Exodus that occurs. And Second Exodus is the second half event of the last 3.5 years. So it happens in the chronology of Ezekiel 38 and 39 in the last 7 years, in the last days, and before the time of Jacob's trouble that happens in the Great Tribulation. And trouble is the Hebrew word sarah, tribulation, or affliction, or persecution, just as the ellipses is used for tribulation and affliction to describe two different periods in the end time, one being the tribulation of the saints and the other being the great tribulation. Get more of that into section 7, so we'll do that for next week if we get into it. But understand there's cognate sort of words. So we have a timing for this war, and you have these mighty ones and these kings and royals that are destroyed in this war. It's the Armageddon battle, but it's the same language that is used to describe this great slaughter in the God War that happens just before the point of the last 7 years, and it's actually counterfeit Armageddon that Antichrist will take credit for winning, just as he has to counterfeit all of the credentials of Jesus. He has to come before Jesus does. And we have the mighty ones and these things that are being killed, and it's the exact kind of language that's going to happen at Armageddon. And then you have Joel 1 and 2, where you have the mighty ones that are describing Gog War. We also have the mighty ones that are also talked about in Joel 3, which is the Armageddon War. And you have mighty ones connected to the royals and the names of giants like Gog and Magog. And Gog is the son of, from the Antediluvian perspective, is the son of Iapetus. He also had Albion and Magog as giant sons as well. And in leader of this war is Gog of Magog, chief prince of Meshech, and Meshech is the etymological root for Moscow. And so you have this connection of giants in terms of nations, and you have giants in terms of actual giants that are associated in that alliance with the leadership. And Gog doesn't show up in the table of nations, but Magog does as a descendant of Japheth. And what happened is that descendants of Seth, they moved into the Asia Minor area and intermarried with the giants, where their names were changed to reflect that. So they have a giant name that's sort of attached for it. And we also talked about the Herculides line, and we may even mention the Creta gens, which is the gens from Zeus and the patriarchal bloodline of the king. And many of those Gyges kings are called Gog and Magog, and there are also nations with patronymic titles of those kings that they come down as part of the Tyrannus or the Arwanos. So you have the mighty men that are connected back to these royals in the end time wars. And what's really important to that is it connects in with the same war that happens before the midpoint of the last 7 years in Revelation 9, which is this 200 million man war. And this 200 million man war has the same type of creatures that are described in Joel 1 and 2. And this war happens after the opening of the pit prison, which is part of the first woe. And so you have these connections to that I start with, and that's chapter 62 after I finish up with the dual prophecies, and I introduce how we can take Greek back to cognate words in Hebrew and understand the same types of bloodlines and the same types of things that are prophesied in Hebrew, but show up in the Greek, both translated into English. So I think I make a pretty good case that these are the same bloodlines that have come down through the beast empires. And now in the end time, you're going to have this 10-king empire and understand it. And I talked about how we understand it as the beast empire in chapter 58, where I talked about Pharaoh and the beast empires, and I started to give that information to understand how we should look at the seventh empire. It's a metallic empire in Daniel 2, but described the beast empire, and all these Ephraim beast empires, the seven, are described as beast empires, as we would understand the beast of the Daniel prophecy in chapter 7. So start to link sort of together, starting in chapter 58, get into the prophecies and come back for how we know that these are the descendants of those beast empires that are going to make up those 10 kings that make 10 empires or groups of nations that are going to rule this world. And interestingly enough, the UN has the world divided into 10 groups of nations. The Club of Rome divided the world up into 10 nations. And yet we have this prophecy of this worldwide empire of 10 kings that comes along in the end time. That is the seventh beast empire that's shown in Revelation 12, 13, and 17. That is part of this Leviathan dragon creature that comes up out of the Gentile sea to resurface in the end time. And each of these empires have a specific relationship with Israel. And that's accounted for throughout Israel's history. And as I noted, their beginnings with Egypt. In 721, you had Assyria take the northern kingdom way into exile and dispersed into the four corners of the world and lost into history. They'll be called back by name in the end time, and likely by 144,000, but it's that interrelationship of the beast empires. And then starting Daniel's time, you get to the last five empires, and you have Babylon that takes the southern kingdom into exile, breaking the covenant. The Persian king comes along and starts the process along with the Medes kings to permit Israel or the southern kingdom of Judah to go back to the covenant land and rebuild their civilization in the temple. You have the Greek Empire that controls all of the land of Israel, actually do some abomination type of scenarios as well. That is a foreshadow and an understanding for what Antichrist does in the end time. You also have, after that, you have the Roman Empire, which was part of the organizational structure that helped with the crucifixion of Jesus. It was the one that destroyed Jerusalem and dispersed modern Judah to the four corners of the earth. And not until 1947 were they able to move back to their land and declare a nation state there again. And I think as one of the signs as we move closer to that fig tree generation. So it's an important sort of connection to understand that these great mighty men are the royals from the beast empire of the Iron Empire of the great beast empire of the time of Jesus and the disciples that rises in end time, but on a global scale.
Gary, still there?
I am.
I lost you, I think.
Oh, how long ago did you lose me?
Oh, yeah, you were suddenly quiet, and it was like, oh my gosh, did he stop for me to talk, or did he just stop?
Oh, I thought maybe we were off air for a second or something. So, no, I just thought that was a good place to stop.
Oh, okay. Well, it just occurred to me that you've laid this all out so beautifully. They say that history is written by the winners. And this is prophecy for times yet to come. But don't you think that those people, the bad guys, all know about what is being written? And I'm wondering, are they sitting and laughing someplace, or do they know something we don't know? Or, this feels preordained, but because of free will and free choice, that doesn't really mean anything. So it makes one begin to wonder, okay, so this is what has been prophesized, but does that mean it's carved in stone?
It is for a specific time. So you raise a good point where all of the bloodlines and the governments through time, they've known about the prophecies of the Bible. They have their own prophecies within each of the religions, and they're all quite similar because it's the same original pantheon where this information would come from. And I'll get more into some of that in section 7 from some of the sources of the polytheist prophets. They envision an end time as well. They envision a destruction by fire in the age of Aquarius that we're in right now. Now, it could be up to 2,000 years or 300 years in the celestial procession, but nonetheless in the time of the water bearer, the destruction of fire. So they have an understanding that there to be a polytheist Messiah that comes along. And so they have same understanding of end time as they would have of the monotheist land of prehistory, the time before the flood and early after the flood. And they have accountings of that because they have their own prophecies. And that they have a different outcome than what the monotheist outcome is. And so they're still in full belief that they're going to win this thing. And even if this world is destroyed, that doesn't really matter because they're going to have a place for their disembodied spirits in a world that has to be renewed again. And so similar to what happened with the destruction in, as I opened up with the Second Peter passage about the world that was destroyed by fire that caused all of the waters to collapse, and that fire is reserved for the end time. they believe that in sort of that analogy or allegory of Phoenix rising out of the ashes, that that's what it's going to be like. And that Shiva, the destroyer god, and, you know, associated with CERN for obvious reasons, if you really get into the details of CERN, is a destroyer god that would be equated with Abaddon and Apollyon, which both mean destroyer in Hebrew and in Greek, and that's the one who leads the fallen angels out of the prison before the midpoint. And I equate that with Azazel. I make a case throughout the book and get a little bit closer to it as you get into section 7. I lay it out a little bit clearer in that this is the one that provides all the arts. This is the leader of the fallen angels who provided all the arts and the craft, all the angelic technology to train the giant for war, to make the weapons, and gave it enough technology that it could have destroyed the world by fire, but didn't because God interceded with a flood. And that's the technology that we're just catching up to now with all of the knowledge that there was before the flood to destroy the world by fire and to do DNA manipulation, just as we understand that coming to effect with the Chimera technology of DNA manipulation and plant genome reimagination and redesign, that all the world was corrupted before the flood, which is the Hebrew word chakath, which means to decay, to pervert, to ruin, to destroy. And thus, another reason for the flood, and that included all of the plant genome, all the animal DNA, and most of the human DNA, and except for the eight that were called as a restart for humans on the ark, and all the animals that God knew that could represent and repopulate the earth from the species were called that were also free of that contamination start after the flood. So when we start to put, you know, those kinds of details together, is that they don't mind if the world is completely destroyed because they believe that would wipe humanity from the face of memory in the earth, and that they would inherit renewed earth by the fallen angels. They would be provided oikotarians for, that we covered off in section one, a dwelling place for the spirit, as in a clone-type body, or a sieve, as an altered carbon series was talking about, or this consciousness transfer. You can imagine that as being part of transhumanism as well, particularly with that type of terminology. And also imagine that these beings that are talked about in this 200-million-man war, the riders and the horses, would be Chimera type of technology and part of what comes up out of the prison.
Gotcha. One of the other things that has fascinated me with this, there's a lot, and we could probably go on for 3 or 4 hours, but I realize we are limited. The King of Jerusalem seems to come in here as being very important. And what I'm fascinated with is that the title King of Jerusalem is one that still exists today. So what is so significant about the King of Jerusalem?
Use it as a highlight to all of the Antichrist bloodline wannabes around the world. And there will be multiple antichrists in the end times. So we need to be aware that there will be these rivals. That the King of Jerusalem title highlights it as a sort of self-evident that they would like to present the dragon Messiah or the antichrist and through their bloodlines. And so it's one of those beacons that just sort of compels that understanding of you know, what we can expect. It may not from this bloodline, but it will be sort of like akin to that in terms of how they would present their Antichrist wannabes. So the King of Jerusalem title was crowned to Baldwin II in 1118 in a small Mercury on the Rock of Sion at Mount Hermon and officially crowned leader, just as what we saw with King Charles to get the passing on. And then you have official coronations later. And so the official coronation and ceremonies, the ancient ritual that sort of goes along with it, would have happened at the, you know, the Abbey of Notre Dame, an abbey of Our Lady or Mary that would have been outside of Jerusalem, but where he was found first is on the Rock of Zion in Jerusalem, in a small priory, just as Baldwin the First was first took over from de Bullion, who was also the first provided the title. Actually, de Bullion didn't actually be a king, but he was still the king. He just didn't have the king's title. And so the King of Jerusalem title is accepted by the Anjou because they are descendants of the Merovingians and the ennobling of the bloodlines. And so they look at themselves as having part of the Albigens as part of their bloodline, and that this gens goes back to Nephilim or Rephaim bloodlines, also significant bloodlines as passed on through Daniel Baer for the Anjou, de Bullion, and the Pagan families that I mentioned earlier, that they have bloodlines grafted in from King David, King Saul, and allegedly Jesus and Mary Magdalene in their system, just as the Da Vinci laid out in a fiction, as in a fairy tale that has certain allegories and meaning and certain aspects that are true. It's fiction, but it's got their belief system in there. And so it's the King Saul bloodline that's important. It's the Benjamite bloodline, the first king of Israel. And in the time of the Exodus Wars, Joshua awarded Jerusalem to the Benjamites. And so with that grafting in or the sioning in of these bloodlines, they declared themselves, and along with the bloodlines and allegedly Mary Magdalene and Jesus' bloodline, they declared themselves the King of Jerusalem as the inheritors through the Benjamite Sion to Jerusalem. That's the title they would like to declare as Antichrist, an abomination, when he comes to power. Antichrist comes to power. So it's an important title, and that title has gone down, and I cover some of the intrigue, what happens in the kingdom of heaven. If that sounds familiar, that was a movie, but a lot of these players not quite all accurately portrayed, but all the names are in there. They tell this story about the kingdom of heaven, but this is the bloodline dynasty that's coming down that they want to preserve with the King of Jerusalem title. It's going to be preserved within the Anjou bloodline. Unfortunately, the intrigue, you're going to end up with three different branches as rivals to this King of Jerusalem title. And so the three rivals are this. You have the von Habsburg that have a rival claim to it, and they inherit it through the intermarriage of intermarriage royales from the Lorraine region, which is the de Bullion Anjou and Payon home region that originated with that line. And you have another name that comes down through the Anjou. Again, they make linkages to intermarriage, as I lay out in the chapter here of the Kingdom of Heaven, from the Savoy Anjou of Naples. They have a claim to the King of Jerusalem title. The first two don't actually have the official title as it was passed down. They're disputing how it was passed down. And the current holder is King Philippe Bourbon, son of Juan Carlos Bourbon, who inherited through intermarriage and through intermarriage of the Spanish crown and Habsburg royal bloodline, the title of King of Jerusalem showed up with Juan Carlos. And so Von Habsburg Protestants are saying, no, we're still the legitimate ones, but the one who holds the title is King Philippe today. And he oversees the Royal Masonic Order that Queen Elizabeth had a chair at, that one presumes King Charles III would also sit at that table, as part of the large sort of alliance or membership and understanding that the Windsors have their own Royal Masonic Order of the Garter that we talked about earlier. But that is the Order of the Golden Fleece. But you have, within the Anjou, you have three claiming the King of Jerusalem title. And you can make a good claim that the bloodlines of King Charles, and as we take their genealogies back into the Stuarts and back into the Anjou and back to the Hanovers and back to Vlad the Impaler and back to Hercules, has a genealogical claim to the King of Jerusalem title too. It's just that it's clear to me that they actually have any Israelite bloodlines in there. But that doesn't mean the Anjou are going to be the one to present real dragon Messiah. They're going to be rivals. But what it does do is it follows how precious that title is, how it works in and around the whole polemic tree and organizational structure of secret societies and the royal bloodlines. And they expect to utilize this title. Or with another rival they talk about in book one, they envision him coming through Gezer Castles in the main street for his introduction under the huge arch that they have here. They call him the Grand Monarch. So lots of different ones that are out there with similar types of stories. You have coming out of Islam, you have both the Shia and the Sunni who have Messiah-type figures called the Mahdi. And they're two different ones in the two different sects of Islam. They expect to show up in the end. You have, as we talk about in book one, the Hindu bloodline and the new Buddha or Lord Maitreya. One should expect a bloodline from places elsewhere around the world that would come out of the Chinese bloodlines as well, claiming that. And, of course, we have Xi, bloodline of Xia Dynasty, Dragon King, who was overthrown by communism heading up China today and has dynastic plans. So I use the King of Jerusalem title because it interconnects with the Templars, it interconnects with the Mary apparition, and similar types of vision. It interconnects with ancient history. It just highlights that in the culture of the royals is this obsession to have the dynasty that's going to rule the world.
It is fascinating and confusing. In that, you know, while we have our separate nations and our countries and our leaders, that there is a whole nother group that have their genealogies that take them all the way back to ancient times, who are going to at some point step forward and say, I'm entitled to this. This is my title. And I can see wars breaking out over this.
Going to be a lot of wars as these 10 empires start to take shape. And the Western bloodlines have their own vision and want to impose that vision on the rest of the world. So if we're in the fig tree generation, and I think with the taking of Jerusalem by the Southern Kingdom in 1967, I think we might be. I don't know how long the generation is. Could be 70 years from that point in time or 120 years. But I think we're going to see more of that empire building going on. And what we clearly see, Putin, who also believes he has royal bloodlines, is he's saying to the Western bloodlines that I see this new world order in the same way you see it, and I want a larger role. President Xi is saying the same thing. And the last president of the U.S., Trump, was saying to Western bloodlines the same thing. Well, I want a larger role for the U.S. in this new world order. I'm not necessarily against it. I just want a larger role. And then we saw how all of the Western hegemony rose again, President, and we're still seeing that to this day, whether you like it or not. There's never been a reaction to somebody in this kind of manner, because he's pushing back on moving forward on the globalist agenda, at least in a way that they don't like, and not something that they want to have, having that kind of power to influence what they can and they can't do. I expect we're going to see wars over this New World Order, the Nephilim, or Nephilim World Order, as I like to call it, that's going to cause a lot of catastrophe and damage, and I think we're going to see those wars continue. And I would expect to see a significant war between the Shia and the Sunni as we get closer to the end time. So we're going to see a lot of things that look apocalyptic-like, but we're not there yet. And so even with the seal judgments, 25% destruction of all of the people in the world through wars, earthquakes, pestilence, famine, and earthquakes. And those are the same catastrophes that are part of the sorrow. So if we saw a destruction, let's say, of 5% of the world's population, 10%, people are going to say, that's Armageddon as we're going through it. There's a lot more destruction to come, because there's going to be this funneling down to these 10 rulers, and then you're going to have Antichrist rise out of that, and he's going to overthrow 3 of them.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, we come under one umbrella, and how are these 10 kings going to react to someone stepping in and saying, thank you guys for doing all this work, I'll take it from here?
And that's why I think it's important to understand the glue to this whole thing coming together is the universal religion, because it's common to these royal bloodlines that would bring some sense of unity. And so as you see the woman riding the beast of empires in the book of Revelation, and in chapter 17, and holding reins over this East Empire, just as the daughters of Babylon did all through the Beast Empire. And this is starting to get a little bit into section 7. But you're going to require the universal religion to bring this together, and it'll be the universal religion that sponsors the rising Antichrist to negotiate the 7-year covenant of the last 7 years, when these kings, New World Order, but they're subservient to the Mother Goddess and the religious nature of the woman of Babylon.
It's mind-boggling. And, you know, I think the one thing that somebody asked me, what is the meaning of the fig tree generation?
Yeah, so it shows up in Matthew 24 and Mark 13 and Luke 17 and 21 with the oration of the end time events that Jesus provides. And he gives an exact chronology. And we know it's sequential in the events that he's doing. And I do cover this in section 6, and then I'll recover it again as it becomes really important in section 7. When Jesus says then, that's the Greek word, Coda. And that exactly in Greek was as how it was translated into English. It's then, it's the when. And this happens, and this happens. So it's used over and over in there to denote the sequence, with the abomination in the middle of his sequence of events that represents the midpoint of the last 7 years. And then we're to reference Daniel and all of the passages in Daniel 9 and 11 and 12 about the abomination. That happens at the point for the timing. And so after the sequence of events is provided, then Jesus talks about the fig tree generation, that everything that I predicted in this sequence of prophecy will take place in the generation, and heaven and earth will, but my word will never pass away. So he's pretty firm that everything that he said is going to be happening in this fig tree generation. So what's the fig tree? And again, I'll cover this off, and we'll probably cover it off to a certain degree next but it is when Jesus is going into his latter part of his commission, he walks up to a fig tree, takes a fruit from it, and eats it, and then it kills the fig tree because it's no longer bearing fruit. And that was a sign to the disciples and to people, his followers, that the fig tree is the southern kingdom and that it was going to be destroyed. And then he goes into immediately pretty much thereafter and gives prophecy of the destruction of the temple and the destruction of Jerusalem. And then after that, the disciples are going to ask him, what will be the signs of your coming? So how do we know the fig tree is being representative of the southern kingdom and the disciples recognize that? It's because in the Old Testament, the northern kingdom in prophetic allegory and passages are talked about as the vine. And just as Ephraim is like a great vine, and other passages of Israel as being a vine, and it's part of God's garden, and the fig tree in the garden is talked about as the southern kingdom. So when we get into that in the next section, I'll give passages and verses to back that up. So this is the southern kingdom that was going to be suffering the consequences of rejecting their Messiah and the curses of the covenant, of the Holy Covenant. And it was, the city was going to be destroyed, and Judah was going to be dispersed to the four winds, not lost, still visible within the world, versus the lost tribes of the northern kingdom. And so we see the leaves are new and tender on this fig tree. That's when Judah comes back into the land, just as it has to be there in end-time prophecies, as we talked about in for Daniel and Jerusalem being the epicenter for end-time prophecy. Know that the season is near and that the time is near, and that is the generation when that happens, when all of the events Jesus prophesied will take place. And because Revelation is the testimony of Jesus, those events as well.
Okay. So in your theory that we are in the fig tree generation, which would be, well, a generation is what, 120 years? Roughly?
Or 70 if we use 1967 as a start point. 40 years wouldn't work because we'd have to be in the last 7 years by now. And 70 years is plausible if you look at, you know, the 2030s and maybe first part of the 2040s. So we don't know whether or not things can happen that fast, or it'll take longer, or if the generation is at 720. And who knows, we could be wrong. This may not be the fig tree generation, but things seem to be lining up that we are in the fig tree generation.
Well, a lot better than that poor man at Times Square that, you know, the end is near. I think this is probably the fourth or fifth generation of that family that has walked around with that placard on, you know.
Yeah.
But every generation does claim it's the last generation. But and you know, you have definitely put out an amazing case for the fact that we probably are very close to that, and it just we don't have time to get into some of the really good stuff here, that like the rogue Jesuits and Our Lady of Notre Dame and Francis Borgia. And I loved, you know, I began to see names that I could relate to in history, and it gave me a better frame of reference to sort of understand what was going on. And these houses, these family lines that have, you know, come through time, to be a member of it almost chooses for you what your destiny pathway is, because it's been the cause for the family for so very, very long. And it does, I mean, you look at King Charles, and I really thought that he was going to be the end of that particular line. Do these lines die out, don't they? I mean, there are some times when they just don't keep going because they can't.
That's true, and they'll try and pass that on to a relative, as in a close proximity of the family line, to take over. And you would see that when the Stuart line came to an end, and they went to the Hanover bloodline, which is the current Windsor bloodline, and they changed their name to Windsor in World War One for obvious reasons when you're having wars against the Germans.
Yeah.
But they were cousins back then, all intermarried. And so they would have that succession through right of inheritance with the rights that they have that have been placed since the flood, and probably the same rights of inheritance that were in place before the flood. And so that's all sort of set out how that would play out. It doesn't mean that, it doesn't change the natural inheritance rules through an arrival just usurping it, right? And even when the Tudor line came to an end with Elizabeth, I mean, Mary Queen of Scots, who was a cousin of Queen Elizabeth, right? So it was a natural sort of thing to do, is to go to the Stuart kingship to transplant that into England. It's always their preference is to do that. And even when they were trying to put a Protestant bloodline in, they had cousins of intermarriage between the Orange Stuarts and Jacobites, or not Jacobites, but the Orange Stuarts that became kings in the Protestant reign. So they're always trying to keep that with at least that intermarriage of the dynasties. So it's important for them to maintain the kind of control. Sometimes it doesn't work that way, and sometimes there's less bloodlines that would go over. I think that the Tudor bloodline as an inferior bloodline that took over from the Plantagenet, which is the junior offshoot of the Anjou. So that's why you have all of that intrigue about, the fall of the Plantagenet / Anjou king of England and usurped by Henry VIII.
Well, yeah, look at Queen Victoria. I mean, she spread her genes all over Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, World War One was basically an inter-family squabble. World War One, which overflowed into World War Two. So, between the Kaisers and the Romanovs and the Habsburgs and the Bourbon and the Savoy and the different lines of the Anjou, it was an inter-family squabble for control. But they can get quite vicious on that.
And it's still going on.
And it's still going
Putin.
On today.
Look at Putin, what he's doing. I mean, it just, it is overwhelming to think that this kind of intrigue is going on in spite of the fact that we think we're civilized and we don't do this anymore. But we do. Go ahead.
And I was going to say, the Romanov dynasty is the junior offshoot of the Putianin dynasty out of Kiev, just as the Plantagenet are a junior offshoot of the Anjou and intermarriage. So in the 1600s, the Romanovs intermarriage, take over the throne, but it's still part of the Putianin bloodline. This is one member that's part of the Putianin, the intermarriage. And that Russia was set up in 1000 AD by Vladimir the Great as a branch of the Putianin Tsars, and the Putianin Tsars are the original Tsars that ruled in Kiev, and it's like the holy city of the Putianin bloodline. And that Putin believes his grandfather or grandfather, depending on which version you're reading on this, was an outside the marriage of Putianin royal dynasties in the 1850s of Kiev. And so he receives part of the name, some wealth, and part of the nobility. And when his father moved to St. Petersburg in around the time of World War One, that's how he ends up in Putin. And Putin's name doesn't show anywhere before his grandfather or great-grandfather. And so he believes that he is the legitimate inheritor of the Putin bloodline, and he also believes that social masonry was sent to Russia by the Western bloodlines to bring down a more pure bloodline that was a rival that they could not bring over. There was a big disagreement, and that ended up with the Putin and Romanov bloodline being almost wiped out completely or totally wiped out, depending on whether or not you believe there is any dissent. So he's just trying to put together in his belief what the old Romanov dynasty was what he stated in his interview with Tucker.
Wow. I just noticed the time. You need to put out there where they can get it, where people can get a hold of you and your books and find you on the internet.
Yeah, so the best way to get a hold of me is through my website, thegenesis6conspiracy.com. That's the Genesis 6, the number 6, conspiracy.com. On that website, there's a contact the author. So if you want to ask me for a document on Putin or any other ones that I might have talked about tonight, or ask me whether or not I have a document on a topic, just ask me a question, go to contact the author on that website. There's a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters of book one and all 84 chapters of book two on the website. And I think if the table of contents will get your interest, there's a generous excerpt. That should get your interest as well, but I think you've read the whole book because it's just a drop in the bucket. If you've not read a book that I've written, you have no idea how much information is in there until you've read one. It just keeps coming at you. So, and if you've got an interest in purchasing the book, you can go to the Buy Now page and click on book one or book two. And if you live in Canada, there's a Canadian page. If you live in the U.S., there's a U.S. page. If you live anywhere else in the world, you just go to the international page, and that's how you get a signed copy. And if you wanted to link over to Amazon to get a digital version, you can link over, have a Kindle connection that takes you to the Kindle version on Amazon. I also have a link to Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, also the BarnesNoble.com. And hopefully by the end of June, we'll have a link up there as well to Amazon for the audio version of book one. And I've started reviewing some of the audio chapters on that already. And then book two by the end of August or into September should be up there and available on Amazon as well. So that's the best way to get a hold of me. Contact the author or to buy my book. It's the fastest, easiest way to get hold of a book, whether you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Kindle version or buy a signed copy. However you want to support me, if you want to support me, that's how you do it, because I do not take donations.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'm so looking forward to next week's show and the final chapters. Thank you so much, Gary. I so appreciate your spending so much time with us and sharing so much information. And what's amazing is we only skimmed the surface. So I'm so looking forward to seeing how we tie this up. And then, of course, in the August and in the fall, we're going to do book one in the same manner. So thank you for spending the time with me and for putting up with my questions.
Well, that's what we're here to do, because we want to be able to get the information out there, and you always ask such good questions, so it's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much, and I will talk to you next Monday.
Sounds good. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. Do tune in next week for the final chapter in this series, and then after that, every Monday, we'll keep it going, and so will Mark. Thanks for listening. Good night, everybody.